Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
The light bulb had been removed, deliberately taken out of its socket the minute the prisoners were forced inside. A chilling void filled the tiny subterranean basement, its walls made of cold stone, its floor lined with rocks and dirt. The four adults trapped inside the cramped room shared their meager space with the old brick building's boiler and its labyrinth of pipes snaking across the walls. Together, the captives had fashioned a sorry excuse for a bed out of grimy clothes piled atop the earthen floor, although one of them couldn't even make use of the small sliver of comfort because his legs were chained firmly to a boiler pipe. In the pitch-black darkness, two emaciated dogs joined the prisoners. The stench of human and animal waste permeated the air, courtesy of a lone metal bucket doubling as a toilet. It was the raw smell of despair, the smell of death. The heavy steel door, chained from the outside, left no hope for escape. All they could do now was wait. And then they heard it, the sound of footsteps approaching. Someone was coming, and in the lightless dungeon, footsteps always meant trouble. It always had before. Suddenly, the metal door swung open wide, revealing a narrow strip of blinding light and a silhouette shrouded in darkness. The captives didn't say a word. Join me now as we take a terrifying look into the Philadelphia basement of horrors. You'll hear the twisted story of a family harboring terrible secrets for more than a decade and about the extraordinary resilience of the human spirit, even when it seems all hope is certainly lost. There were definitely no pets allowed at the building on Longshore Avenue. The landlord had made that perfectly clear, or at least he thought he had. So why was he finding dog bowls in the basement all of a sudden? A 71-year-old retired Turkish naval officer named Turgut Goslavelli owned this 7-unit apartment building. Located in the historic Tacony neighborhood of northeast Philadelphia, it was the oldest neighborhood in the entire city. The building itself had been converted from an old brick movie theater decades earlier, and now it blended in seamlessly with the aging apartments and row houses along the street. Back in 2011, Tacony was considered a step above some of Philadelphia's more dangerous neighborhoods. But still, like most inner-city areas, it wasn't immune to its fair share of crime and riffraff. Aside from noticing that one of his tenants was secretly keeping some pets, the landlord had received a number of calls that week that had to be addressed. A neighbor had called complaining about some of his tenants holding an impromptu flea market on the sidewalk, trying to sell piles of used clothing to people who passed by. Another resident told Turgut she'd seen an SUV with out-of-state plates pull up to the building and then watched as people were unloaded from the rear hatch and taken inside. That week, Turgut had gone to each unit, speaking with his tenants, asking them all the same question, "Is anyone feeding a pet?" But of course, every single person denied it. On Saturday morning, October 15th, 2011, the landlord finally heard it. A barking dog, and it sounded like it was coming from the basement. Going down to investigate, Turgut found it completely empty, except for the same empty dog bowls he'd noticed previously. But the basement also had a sub-basement down another small set of stairs. It was mostly just a space to house the building's water heaters, and perhaps, he suspected, a secret pet animal or two. Turning on his flashlight, Turgut descended the steps, and then he noticed something strange. The sub-basement contained an old boiler room off to the side, one that hadn't been used in many years. Its heavy door was always closed, but in the beam of the flashlight, he could see that someone had deliberately chained it shut. Not knowing what he might find on the other side, the landlord cut the chain and pushed the door open. Shining his flashlight in the pitch-black room, he saw a dirty quilt with something obviously beneath it. When he pulled back the edges, two sets of eyes stared back at him. Human eyes, a man and a woman, cowering in fear. He didn't see the others, not at first. The landlord's first instinct was that they were squatters, but how could squatters chain themselves inside a room from the outside? "What the hell are you doing here?" he asked them. But they didn't say a word back. Not knowing what he was dealing with, the landlord quickly exited the room, shutting the door before calling 911. Once police arrived, they headed to the boiler room with the landlord. Inside, they found a total of four people. Two the landlord had found, another man hiding inside a grimy sleeping bag, and another man chained to one of the boiler pipes. Using a hacksaw, the landlord cut the chain away and set the man free. These people clearly looked like they'd been kept against their will. But instead of thanking the rescuers with open arms, the captives instead pleaded with police to leave and let them stay, telling the officers they'd be killed if they ever left the room. Whoever had confined these four individuals had clearly instilled in them the deepest kind of fear imaginable. But when they brought them out of the basement on stretchers, the extent of their physical trauma and deterioration became all too apparent. The landlord would later say they were tired, beat up looking, thirsty and hungry. They didn't know what world they were living in. Their bodies showed signs of long-term abuse, old scars mixed with fresh wounds. And they were on the brink of starvation, just skin and bones, with hardly an ounce of body fat. Looking at the victims, Turgut believed he'd found them just in the nick of time. If he found them 24 hours later, he couldn't imagine them still being alive. Two small dogs were also discovered in the boiler room, the source of the barking that had initially alerted the landlord. And like the other captives, they were also malnourished, mistreated, and abused. The man who'd been found chained to the boiler couldn't even lie down to sleep. 41-year-old Derwin McLemire had gone missing from Florida almost a year earlier. The man discovered in the sleeping bag was 40-year-old Herbert Knowles, a Virginia man who'd been missing for 3 years. The woman rescued from the boiler room was 29-year-old Tamara Breeden. The third man next to her huddled under the quilt was her boyfriend, 31-year-old Edwin Sanabria, both from Philadelphia. The couple had been missing for an astonishing 10 years. Immediately, the captives were taken to a nearby hospital and provided with life-saving treatment. During this process, police realized yet another heartbreaking aspect to the depravity they'd already witnessed. The victims all appeared to be individuals with intellectual disabilities, each reportedly possessing a mental capacity equivalent to that of a 10-year-old child. Before they were taken away from the horrific scene, Tamara Breeden wanted to let everyone know who had done this to them. "Linda brought us here," she told the landlord, and he knew exactly who she meant. Thinning hair. At my age, it's something you worry about. I remember it was probably in my 40s. I was at my buddy's cottage and we were swimming. And my friend looks at me and says, "Hey, Ty, looks like your hair's getting a little thin there on the back." And I'm like, "What?" And I can still remember. I was absolutely panicked. So the next time I'm getting my hair cut, I asked my barber and I said, "So am I getting thin back there?" And he says, "No, but your hair is thin. The good news is you got a lot of it." And that didn't put me at ease at all. Did you know that over half of us will experience hair thinning at some point in our lives? It's not only common, it's normal. So why not join me and over a million people who are doing something about it with Nutrafol? Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding. Physician formulated with drug-free ingredients, Nutrafol supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting key root causes of thinning stress, hormones, environmental, nutrition, lifestyle, and metabolism through whole body health. With Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple. Purchase online, no prescription or doctor's visits required. Free shipping and automated deliveries ensure you'll never miss a day. See results in 3 to 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code MADNESS. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and stylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS. 51-year-old Linda Ann Weston wasn't a tenant of the building, at least not officially. In fact, it was just earlier that week she started staying in a unit with her daughter, 32-year-old Jean McIntosh. The landlord remembered Linda because he'd met her a few days earlier when a neighbor complained about the illegal flea market on the sidewalk. Linda had been the woman attempting to sell secondhand clothing on the street. When police went to Linda and Jean's apartment, it didn't take long for them to realize the captives in the boiler room were just the tip of the iceberg. They'd soon find evidence that Linda, Jean, and several other accomplices had been running a sickening criminal enterprise for the past decade, preying on vulnerable people with disabilities and stealing their Social Security and disability benefits. Detectives would eventually uncover Social Security cards, driver's licenses, and other identifying documents from approximately 50 different people. But the worst thing they'd find was another victim, Linda's niece, 19-year-old Beatrice Weston. For the past 2 weeks, Beatrice had been locked inside a bathroom closet, treated the same as the victims in the boiler room. When police were able to interview Beatrice, she was more than ready to tell them the truth about everything that had happened to her and how she'd been suffering unimaginable abuse at the hands of her Aunt Linda and Cousin Jean since she was only 10 years old. When detectives examined the extensive constellation of scars covering her body, there was zero doubt Beatrice was telling the truth. The Philadelphia Chief of Police, Charles Ramsey, claimed that during his entire 40 years of being a police officer, he'd never seen a victim whose injuries were any more severe than what he saw with this young woman. At least, not a living victim.
The word horrific is not sufficient. We're talking about burn marks where it looks like a spoon was heated and burned. She's got fractures that have healed over. Her ankles, you can see where someone took a pellet gun of some kind and shot her repeatedly in the ankles. She's got wounds to the head. She was wearing garb over her head to hide the scars. I mean, this girl, invisible scars you could just see on her face, on her arms, on her legs. I mean, I've never seen anything like this before in a living person. It's just remarkable that she is alive. On top of that, she's malnourished. So, I mean, when we talk about that kind of cruelty to somebody over and over and over again, there is no penalty, and I repeat, no penalty, that is too harsh for the people that did this. Absolutely no penalty.
hospital x-rays of Beatrice uncovered 11 untreated fractures and numerous BB gun pellets found embedded in various parts of her body. The unrelenting cruelty Linda Weston and her co-conspirators had shown their victims was difficult to overstate. District Attorney Seth Williams was literally at a loss for words.
My grasp of the English language limits how I can describe the facts and the evidence of this case.
Mayor Michael Nutter summed it up this way.
I think this is quite possibly one of the most visible signs of man's inhumanity to man.
Arrested in the wake of these horrific discoveries were a total of 5 people prosecutors would later dub the Weston family. Linda Weston was the undisputed ringleader of the twisted operation. Her right-hand man and boyfriend was 47-year-old Gregory Thomas Sr., a former professional boxer and convicted rapist. A previous boyfriend of Linda's, as well as a drug dealer, Nicholas Woodward. A 50-year-old unhoused man named Eddie Wright. And Linda's daughter, Jean McIntosh. Because police had discovered 5 living victims at the building on Longshore Avenue, this meant they had 5 eyewitnesses who could tell them everything that had happened. And when detectives began listening to their stories, they soon uncovered the horrifying extent of the Weston family's crimes. A bottomless rabbit hole of racketeering, social security fraud, sex trafficking, incest, hate crimes, kidnapping, human slavery, and multiple murders. Back in the late 1970s, Linda Ann Weston was the oldest of 13 siblings growing up in Philadelphia. When her mother died unexpectedly from kidney failure, Linda assumed leadership of the household, as none of the siblings' fathers were reportedly present. According to her siblings, Linda, who only had a 4th-grade education, ruled the family with an iron fist, subjecting them to beatings, locking them in rooms, and even drugging them to keep them in line. One of her favorite punishments was making her siblings eat cockroaches if they ever misbehaved. Some even claimed Linda forced them to do other unimaginable things.
She would force my brothers and sisters, like my younger ones, she would force them to have sex. She would have sex with my other brothers and sisters. She said, look, make them have babies, then we can get more money. It could be a brother and sister in her care.
Court records also indicate Linda herself had been similarly abused and victimized by her family, including incest, beginning at the age of 9. Her lawyer would later comment on this horrible cycle of abuse, stating, nothing that Linda Weston did was not also done to her as a child. And while this may be true to some extent, the degree to which Linda would perpetuate this cycle was simply unimaginable and unprecedented in scale. By 1981, Linda was 21, living in an apartment with her 2 children, including Jean, her 19-year-old sister Venus, and 12-year-old brother. In October, Venus became pregnant, and the name of the father was Bernardo Ramos. According to court records, one day Bernardo came over to her apartment, indicating he wasn't planning on financially supporting Venus and their child. Linda was so infuriated, she went out behind Bernardo and started hitting him with a broomstick. And with the help of their brother, Linda and Venus tied Bernardo's hands and feet together before forcing him into a closet. There, Bernardo remained trapped for the next 2 months without food. Linda even punished her brother for trying to offer Bernardo food once. The punishment? Locking him inside this same closet with Bernardo for weeks on end. Eventually, Bernardo died of starvation, and Linda's brother was only allowed out of the closet to help dispose of Bernardo's body. They placed him in a baby stroller and wheeled him out to a parking lot where they left him there. By the time Bernardo died, he only weighed 75 pounds. When authorities discovered his body, they initially thought he'd died of natural causes. Clearly, there hadn't been a very thorough investigation. Not long after Bernardo's murder, Venus gave birth to a healthy baby girl, Linda's niece, Beatrice Weston. For nearly 2 years, Linda and Venus believed they'd gotten away with murder. But in 1983, an unidentified family member called police and told them what really happened to Bernardo. So both Venus and Linda were charged and convicted of third-degree murder. Linda was sentenced to 8 years in prison, but was paroled in 1987 after only serving 4 years. In 1993, Linda, a convicted murderer, went to family court and astonishingly was able to successfully regain custody of her children. Around the same time, Linda also began a relationship with Gregory Thomas Sr., and together, they had 4 more children. In 2001, Linda befriended a couple in their neighborhood, Tamara Breeden and Edwin Zanabria, both born developmentally disabled. Linda offered Tamara a job babysitting her kids, but instead of paying in cash, she offered Tamara and Edwin a place to stay. At first, Linda was exceptionally nice to the young couple, earning their trust and becoming a motherly figure to them. By early 2002, Linda had become a representative payee for Tamara and Edwin's Social Security payments, managing their government funds. But here's the thing. It's illegal for convicted felons to become a person's representative payee. So how did Linda get away with it? On the state's representative payee application, where it asks about felony convictions, Linda simply ticked the no box. It was that easy. Not a single Social Security administrator ever investigated her self-reported answers. Now that Linda had financial control over Tamara and Edwin's monthly checks, everything changed dramatically. Gone was the comforting motherly figure, and in stepped in the real Linda, mentally and physically abusing the couple, never allowing them to leave. They'd become her captives. On a daily basis, Linda would drug their food and drinks with depressants to keep them compliant and docile, routinely confining them to closets, basements, and attics. As long as the checks were coming in the mail, that's all that mattered to Linda. Until she decided it wasn't enough. In the early 2000s, Linda started an intimate relationship with a local woman named Maxine Lee, who'd been estranged from her family. Just the type of vulnerable victim a predator like Linda was looking for. Posing as a girlfriend, Linda persuaded Maxine to move in, only for Maxine to endure similar abuses as the other victims. She was also forced to take on household chores, like cooking and cleaning, as well as babysitting. And if she did anything Linda didn't like, Maxine was severely punished. Haunting descriptions of this abuse are detailed in court records stating, Linda and Jean would jump Maxine, striking her in the face and body with their fists, open hands, sticks, hammers, and bats. This was all witnessed by all the children. Eventually, even the children were permitted to beat Maxine. At one point, the children realized that if you hit Maxine hard enough, she would make funny sounds. They then began to hit her for sport. She was beaten on almost a daily basis, injuries that were never treated. In 2002, Linda obtained custody of her 10-year-old niece, Beatrice Weston, the daughter of her sister Venus, and the man they'd starved to death in a closet. It's unclear how a convicted murderer like Linda was legally allowed to gain custody. The most likely explanation was that her background simply was never checked. According to Beatrice, Linda was nothing but perfect for her first 10 months, the period of time when the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services was monitoring the situation closely. But as soon as Linda was awarded full custody, Beatrice became a prisoner like the others, forced to live in confinement and subjected to physical and psychological torture. At this point, Linda was imprisoning four people: Tamara, Edwin, Maxine, and Beatrice. But still, Linda wasn't finished. Not by a long shot. As we started researching this increasingly horrific case, we were struck by its haunting similarities to a number of infamous cases. Cases where predatory opportunists take advantage of broken welfare systems in order to enrich themselves. They almost always do this by targeting the most vulnerable and defenseless victims possible, the very type of people these systems are designed to protect. The most shocking case that comes to mind is the case of Dorothea Puente, a seemingly harmless elderly woman who ran a boarding house for the elderly and disabled in Sacramento, California in the 1980s. Despite looking like the sweetest grandmother on earth, Dorothea was actually a cold and calculating serial killer who killed her tenants to collect their Social Security checks. In 1988, seven bodies were discovered buried in her backyard. And for Linda Weston, it was only a matter of time before the bodies started piling up. In April 2005, 59-year-old Donna Spadia also began living at the home. How they crossed paths isn't entirely clear, but like Tamara and Edwin, Linda became Donna's representative payee. Much like her fellow captives, Donna found herself confined to a basement room, dosed daily with drugs, so she'd immediately fall asleep. At first, Donna begged Linda to set her free, but after a few weeks, Donna became almost entirely non-communicative and deteriorated rapidly. By the end of June, Donna had died. To get rid of her body, Linda staged the scene in the basement to make it look like Donna had died from natural causes. She moved her other captives temporarily to another location and set up the basement to look like a bedroom. She then tucked Donna underneath the covers before calling police. And the plan worked. Donna's death was ruled natural. It wouldn't be until years later that a medical re-examination would determine her death would be the result of multiple drug intoxication. Donna's death prompted Linda to seek out more government benefits, leading to a sinister plan. Using threats and coercion, she forced Tamara and Edwin to have two children beginning in 2006. When Tamara gave birth at the hospital, she was instructed by Linda to go by the name Jean McIntosh, a deceit that extended to the children's birth certificates. That way, Linda's daughter, the real Jean McIntosh, could pretend the children were hers, allowing Linda to collect even more Social Security benefits. To further the horror, Linda deceived Tamara and Edwin into believing their own children had died. For years, they remained oblivious to the truth, unsuspecting that the toddlers living upstairs with Jean and Linda were, in fact, their own flesh and blood. In 2008, the Weston family moved from Philadelphia to Norfolk, Virginia. By this point, Maxine Lee had lost approximately 80 pounds since being abducted and was small enough to fit in the cabinet under the kitchen sink, which unbelievably is exactly where Linda decided to lock her up. When Maxine managed to break out, Linda locked her up in the upstairs attic with Edwin, Tamara, and Beatrice. A single bucket was shared between them to use as a toilet, the same bucket used to feed them their meals of ramen noodles laced with sleep-inducing drugs. It was only during the late summer that Tamara and Edwin were allowed to leave the attic, because the temperatures in the attic were alarmingly high, and Edwin was only born with one lung. He nearly suffocated at one point. But Beatrice and Maxine weren't allowed out. Instead, Maxine and Beatrice were stripped of their clothing and forced to sleep on top of the pink fiberglass insulation covering the attic floor. What Linda was doing to her four captives was pure relentless torture. Eventually, the horrific conditions, combined with extreme malnutrition, led to Maxine dying in 2009. She was 39. Again, Linda staged the scene before calling the authorities, and like Donna, she tucked Maxine under the covers in one of the bedrooms, making it appear as if she died watching TV. The medical examiners performed a full autopsy on Maxine, but her cause of death was ruled as natural, brought on by acute bacterial meningitis. Years later, the same medical examiner would reclassify Maxine's death correctly as a homicide. Not long before Maxine's death, Linda had lured another victim named Herbert Knowles, a developmentally disabled man in his late 30s with cerebral palsy. She told Herbert she'd take care of him if he came to live with her, also telling him that Tamara wanted to be his girlfriend. And of course, Linda quickly became Herbert's representative payee and soon was just another prisoner alongside the others. Despite getting away with murder for a second time in 3 years, Linda didn't want to stick around Norfolk and take any chances. So the day after Maxine's death, the Weston family packed up their SUVs and moved to a town in central Texas. And just when you thought Linda couldn't make it any worse for her captives, she did, forcing Tamara and 17-year-old Beatrice into sex work. Linda, acting as their pimp, rented out a separate trailer for the clients, keeping all the money they earned to herself. It was also here where Linda met one of her accomplices, Eddie Wright, a middle-aged unhoused man. Linda had recruited him to help keep her growing number of captives in line. Basically, Eddie became the muscle whenever Gregory Thomas Sr. wasn't around to dish out punishments. But only after a year in Texas, the Weston family packed their bags and prisoners again, this time moving out to West Palm Beach, Florida. Over the next 16 months, Linda continued pimping out Tamara and Beatrice. If they refused or complained, they were physically punished. Court documents would later reveal that neither of the women was ever offered protection or given gynecological care. By October 2010, Linda had found her next victim using an online dating app, a man named Derwin McLemire. Taking a page from the Maxine Lee playbook, Linda pretended to be in love with him and convinced him to move in with her. Like her other victims, Derwin received monthly checks from the government, having been diagnosed with mood disorders and a developmental disability. Once Derwin moved in, Linda wasted no time stealing his benefits. With the help of a local drug dealer named Nicholas Woodward, Linda locked Derwin inside the house and stole his ID and benefit cards. On one occasion, when Derwin tried running away, Nicholas forced him back into the house at gunpoint. After his escape attempt, Derwin was locked inside a closet and fed once a day, subjected to torture and abuse. The worst was when Linda turned a vicious pit bull on Derwin, and it bit off half his ear. Eventually, the Weston family was evicted from their house because they stopped paying rent. But before leaving, they stripped the house bare of its copper piping and electrical wiring. They also smeared feces on the wall and stole all the home's appliances. They even stole the doorknobs. This time, they headed back to Philadelphia to move into Jean's apartment on Longshore Avenue. It was now October 2011. In an overcrammed SUV, all five captives, Tamara, Edwin, Beatrice, Herbert, and Derwin, were forced to ride in the cargo area with the dogs. Their luggage was thrown on top of them to keep them concealed. The miserable drive took 3 days. When they arrived at Jean's place, a neighbor observed five adults being brought inside from the vehicle's cargo compartment and promptly notified the building's landlord. Days later, the landlord received several more calls about an illegal flea market set up by Linda Weston on the sidewalk. But the thing that was bothering him the most were the dog bowls he'd been finding down in the basement. According to the Philadelphia Inquirer, at the time of Linda Ann Weston's arrest, she was collecting an astonishing $7,500 a month in supplemental security income checks, translating to approximately $90,000 a year. Altogether, Linda was receiving income from a total of 12 individuals, which included her captives' children, and her own children. In 2015, Linda Weston pleaded guilty to all of her crimes in order to remove the possibility of the death penalty. She was sentenced to life without parole, plus an additional 80 years. Gene McIntosh and Nicholas Woodward each pleaded guilty and received 40-year prison sentences. Eddie Wright was sentenced to 27 years. Linda's boyfriend, Gregory Thomas Sr., initially agreed to a plea deal in 2015, but changed his mind at the very last minute. As far as we can tell, his case and sentencing is still pending. The federal prosecution of the Weston family became the first time in United States history where defendants were charged with hate crimes for targeting individuals with mental and physical disabilities. In the wake of these crimes, massive reforms to Social Security oversight were enacted. New legislation passed in 2018 now requires the Social Security Administration to perform background checks on all representative payees and to recheck them every 5 years for felony convictions. The decade-long horror story of the Weston family is one of the most tragic and prolonged cases of sadistic inhumanity we've ever covered. Linda exclusively targeted extremely vulnerable victims by presenting herself as their savior, their rescuer, whatever the victim needed the most at that time in their lives. For some, she became a motherly figure, to others, a girlfriend, and to others, a nurse. But the moment she gained control of their finances, the mask came completely off. But one of the most disturbing aspects of it all is how preventable it could have been. It should never have been possible for Linda to become anyone's representative payee for supplemental security income. And it's not just the Social Security Administration that's come under fire from critics. Numerous times throughout this case, victims' families reported their loved ones as missing, and some of them even straight up told police that Linda Weston had kidnapped them. But Linda and Gene were always able to convince police and social workers that they had nothing to hide. Their favorite method of deception was coaching all their children to do exactly what they say. And since everybody in the house was telling the exact same story, they were believed. Whenever police became too suspicious and started poking around, the family simply packed up and moved to a new location. Still, multiple law enforcement agencies have been heavily criticized for not doing more to intervene. There was also the matter of the three murders of Bernardo, Donna, and Maxine being determined to have died from natural causes. All three were clearly malnourished. It was easier to classify them that way. No need for an investigation. After their release from captivity, the five living survivors of the Weston family cruelty case were all reunited with their families and loved ones. In a 2018 interview, Tamara Breeden told a local reporter she finally wasn't having nightmares anymore about her decade-long ordeal. Today, she spends her time making art and caring for her three children, including the two born in captivity. After his release from the hospital, Herbert Knowles was returned to his extended family, who'd never stopped looking for him since he'd gone missing in 2008. Acting as a spokesperson for the family, his niece told reporters that he'd always been a part of their family and they'd never forgotten about him. Very little information has been made public about Derwin McLemire since his escape from the boiler room. But in 2015, he, alongside the other survivors, was in the Philadelphia courtroom to watch Linda Weston get sentenced to life in prison. Beatrice Weston whose entire childhood was stolen from her by her aunt, was determined to make the most of her future. She began attending therapy twice a week, going to school, and started making new positive connections in her life. In an interview given in 2013, Beatrice said her goal was to become a nurse one day. When Edwin Sanabria went missing in 2001, his family initially believed he'd simply run off with his girlfriend, Tamara Breeden. Edwin's younger brother, Robert, who was 3 years younger than him, remembers how neighbors and friends would occasionally claim they'd seen Edwin in public somewhere, keeping the hope alive that he was still out there somewhere. Over the years, Robert compared these two Bigfoot sightings. 10 years later, when Edwin was in the hospital, recovering after being rescued, Robert, who was now a grown man and a sergeant in the U.S. Army, went with his father to see his older brother for the first time since he was a teenager. At first, Edwin didn't recognize either of them, but after a few stunned seconds, he uttered the word to his father, "Pop?" A few moments later, he looked at his little brother all grown up and said, "Robert?" The family celebrated immediately by going out and getting a taste of Philadelphia, something Edwin hadn't had in a decade, a Philly cheesesteak. And I think we can safely bet that it was the best tasting Philly cheesesteak anybody has ever had. And now I'd like to introduce the podcast, Murder Shelf Book Club.
Hi, this is Jill, host of the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. Each month, I feature a true crime book by one of my favorite authors. But I don't stop there. A psychology educator for 30 years who studied serial murder, I apply what I've learned to these cases, analyzing and updating the story since publication so you don't have to. Told in trilogies, in part 3, I cast a wider net following the threads not tugged on in the book, going into some surprising, bone-chilling directions. Cold cases, homicides, serial killers, family annihilators, cases from history, all the stories that fascinate and appall us. I also give voices to the voiceless, honoring the victims, survivors, and their families. This is your True Crime Book Club, so read with me, or in these busy days, let me read for you. Join me on the Murder Shelf Book Club and see what I'm pulling off my murder shelf next.
Follow the Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @MadnessPod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.